So I start with transparency, which I showed about a year ago when Shamit and Sandeep were at the seminar. They were converted into cosmologists. And I learned it, of course, on many things which I'll tell you I learned from Andrei. And so for cosmologists, it would be useless to show it, they know it. So in the beginning, we had this rapid stage of inflation which seemed to be in agreement with current data. And this was accelerating, which means that there was a positive acceleration. Then this goes into decelerating stage where we have, first of all, there is a reheating or preheating, then radiation and cold dark matter. And then suddenly, this recent discovery is that now, instead of being in a stage of deceleration, we have again a slow acceleration, which is sometimes called late inflation. And whereas this takes, the early one takes just 10 to the minus 35 seconds, this goes for like 7 billion years. And there's a huge difference between those two processes. However, you can still see some similarities. So in the early universe inflation, we have second derivative positive. We have, of course, the universe expands, and it goes in a very short time. And we're getting at least 60 foldings or much more in many models. And what is well known, at least the way it is understood, that there is a definite exit to deceleration, so that this second derivative is now negative and the universe still expands. At late time inflation, which is, as I told you, during last 7 or so billion years, we still have positive second derivative. We still have positive first derivative, but the number of e-foldings so far seem to be just one. And the most interesting part of the story, we don't know anything about the exit, because exit is something in future. And there are, of course, few possibilities. There is a possibility of forever expanding. There is a possibility of just going to Minkowski or collapse. And this is the mystery of dark energy, which I will not talk about, but there is a lot of activities here. And I'll simply proceed with, after this introduction, I'll proceed with outline of my talk.
Is there any chance you could point right at the screen?
Yeah,
it's hard to see.
I think I'm here. There's a pointer right there.
Oh, yes, sure. Thank you. Okay. I'm afraid in a small room it could be dangerous. I don't want to harm anybody, so it's very strong. So let's go like that. All right, so first I want to discuss shortly the model of the sitter space, which leads to this landscape, and just shortly. Then as a warm-up, I'll discuss inflation in n equals 1, d equals 4, supergravity, and I'll talk about F-term and D-term and P-term inflation, which is nicely fitting into some brain construction. I'd like also to discuss the issues which were raised in the recent paper, where in addition to Shamit and Andrei and Sandeep, we had Juan Maldacena and Liam McAllister joining us. And there are all kinds of issues, and I'll discuss two of them here. And then I will proceed with brain inflation models. And in particular, I'll try to explain that D-term inflation is not the same as D-brain inflation, except sometimes. And I like this except, so I'll explain this kind of model. Okay, so shortly, I'll use some of the transparencies which were prepared a while ago by Andrei, and just to give you a short story about the sitter space. It was known that there are no Gauss theorems, and the worst of it was the fact that for many years it was known that you always have these canonical scalars which have exponential dependence, a dilaton and volume. And so the exponents are too steep, and they have runaway behavior. And even if you fix the dilaton, the volume is still extremely bad. And basically, the system, in the process of cosmological evolution, wants to go to flat 10-dimensional space, which means decompactify, because rho wants to go to infinity. Oh, the low part? OK, here is what happens. We fix the dilaton, but the volume still runs to infinity. And this is the major problem. Because we want to have consistent string theory, which means finite gravity in 10 dimension and consistent four-dimensional general relativity. And they are related by the volume. So we have to somehow stabilize this volume and find it finite.
That depends on the sign. I mean, there are effects that go with the opposite sign, positive curvature,
right, but in the most situations which we know, there is this runaway behavior. And
does this mean that there is a region of modular space where you run to infinity, but there could be other regions where...
Yes, I'm coming to that. So the
not away from infinity, down towards stronger.
That's what they're doing.
Right. So what I was telling was, if I am in the regime of, in a situation on type 2B theory with fixed dilaton, I have only to think about the volume, the situation which we studied, which are associated with no scale supergravity, which I'll explain in a minute. The situation is such that the volume tends to decompactify in those cases which I know. It starts small, yeah. Anyway, we need some finite volume if we want to make sense of string theory simultaneously with what, for example, MAP tells us. They can well describe everything in terms of four-dimensional gravity. And so we were working to find the model, and fortunately, Shamit is here. He will respond to all questions of high-level string theory, and Andrei will respond to all top-level cosmology questions, and I'll just translate. So here is the construction which we made with also with Sandeep Trivedi. So we start with type 2B compactification. There are non-trivial fluxes. And we also added a non-perturbative contribution to the potential in presence of anti-D3 brains. And as a result, the dilaton was fixed in Giddings, Koch, Rupolchinsky construction before. And now we fix the modulus, and I'll give a few details on this. And I also want to mention that before, there was the work of Maloney, Silverstein, and Strominger in non-critical string theory, where they also found situations with de Sitter spaces. And I was staring at their potential for a while before we understood how to do it in critical theory. So what is happening here? Because we are using the language of effective four-dimensional theory, and we work in the framework of supersymmetry, which is kind of our hope that eventually supersymmetric particles will be discovered, and also because superstring theory is easily consistent. So here's what we do. What was known before we started this work, that in typical compactification, you end up with something which is called non-scale supergravity. And the reason for it is that the Keller potential depends on this volume modulus, but the superpotential doesn't. And in a situation like that, there is this runaway behavior. So we looked for various sources to break no-scale invariance. And such possible sources were coming from fluxes, and they gave some constant contribution to superpotential, and also from either instantons or Gugino condensations, and they are given by some exponential dependence on rho, which was a source of breaking no scale. As a result, you just calculate the supergravity potential, and you find that with such superpotential, this scalar potential, there is an anti-de Sitter minimum at some negative value, and it is supersymmetric. This was the first part of the construction. Then we had to, and this was not nice, because to have anti-de Sitter is absolutely not what we see today, and we had to do something to uplift this minimum. So this is shortly the story. With just having this non-perturbative superpotential, we had this, in principle, quite deep anti-de Sitter minimum. Then, however, we observed that if in a very special known-to-string theorist picture, we add an anti-D3 brain at the tip of the resolved conifold, the new contribution to the potential depends as some constant over R cube. And this breaks supersymmetry explicitly. However, it nicely uplifts the potential. So this 1 over rho cube is this green line. So if you add this antidissipator as well as this 1 over rho cube, this is the final potential, which has a nice dissipator minimum, more or less at the same position as it was antidissipator, and eventually goes to Minkowski here. This dissipator state is space is metastable, as you see, because the system, there are various ways the system will evolve from here eventually to this decompactification, because large rho means decompactification of the six-dimensional space. So one can think of this model that it may describe late inflation, and the potential is still very steep, so it is not a quintessence. We rather would be able to describe today's situation by just sitting at the minimum, which would mean we have a cosmological constant and the equation of state W equals minus 1.
Well, what if they're already out there?
Where?
Large rho?
This is not what I observed today. So I would say, if I'm here, the model has sense. If I'm here, oh, this is very easy, because I would move in 10 directions, not in 4. Okay. This is easy. Okay. So when this is the project where in progress with Burgess and Quevedo, we have realized that there is an alternative to this model, which has some nice feature of spontaneous breaking of supersymmetry. We may replace this anti-D3 brain by fluxes of the gauge fields on D7 brain. And this will do the uplifting of anti-de-sitter to de-sitter. We have observed that there is, again, this nice contribution, positive contribution to the potential, which behaves like that. And we are working on interpretation of this as a field-dependent D-term. So if everything will work out, which we think it will, we will have additional alternative way of producing the sitter vacuum. And the nice part of this is that the D-flatness condition is broken spontaneously. So we have completely supersymmetric structure, but we do have a de sitter minimum. And this gives some new features to what Lenny called landscape. And of course, there is a possibility to read more about it in the work of Sask and Giddings Douglas and in New York.
Yeah. Gauge on the 7 brain.
Oh, this is not anti-brain. It's just D7. Just D7.
I'm just saying, if you have a 7 brain, you've got a 3 brain in it, that's an instant one in the 7 brain, which could itself be.
Right.
So could this just be the answer to the question, what is the super symmetric effective field you're packaging of the anti-brain in some region of
At the moment, the way we understand it is just in terms of four-dimensional reinterpretation of Keller and superpotential and D-term potential. And so the way we see it, there is a possibility, which we are studying, simply to have a D7 brain and to have some fluxes on it and to have this kind of source of energy. What? Star is X. We're debating the power. X, yeah. Either 1 or 3. I don't know. I don't know yet, but Fernando just sent me a message that he checked with other people, and it seems, yeah.
Can you explain a little bit better the difference between what you mean by spontaneous and...
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So this is... Right. So when I add anti-D3 brain to the system which I had before, I just add a term which is not part of supersymmetric potential. This is what I call break supersymmetry explicitly. Right, right. However, if it is a D term which is not vanishing, then it is the auxiliary field which is not vanishing, but there is simultaneously a stage where it does vanish at this infinity.
And you are not worried in the first situation, the one of explicit breaking? Is that okay?
Can I make a comment? I mean, it seems likely to everyone who's thought about it
that there must in fact be a spontaneous breaking in that case too. Okay. It's just much harder to package in terms of 4D fields.
Okay. Right.
The antibrain is a thin object.
It has to come from sound.
And so it's harder to package. Whereas what
right.
you're describing
so
is easy to package.
What we have realized.
What she's doing likely to be the same thing? Because you could have a gauge bundle with an instanton number on the
same brain. She doesn't even really have to turn on FYGF. That's why I'm not sure.
But turning on FYGF without FYGF. I think it will be slightly easier to explain when I will go through the second part of my talk, which I prepared like just a short review on what is supergravity in D equals 4. Because in the end of the day, if we think of supersymmetry and we think of effective four-dimensional version of it, we have to think in terms of n equals 1 supergravity and d equals 4. And string theory had a lot of studies of the superpotential and almost no studies of d terms. And d terms is, by definition, positive potential, whereas f term is not. And so I want to give you the full picture of n equals 1 supergravity the way I understand it now. So if this is an effective superstring theory, giving us some supergravity and no extra terms. All we know, everybody knows, you have to tell what is your Keller potential, what is your superpotential, which has to be holomorphic. And what is very important for my talk today is attract your attention to the fact that the kinetic term function for the vector multiplet also has to be holomorphic. It become quite an issue, which I'll discuss. So the most general potential, which you can write in n equals 1 supergravity, contains this quite famous term, e to the k, covariant derivative of superpotential minus 3w squared. And it has some connection with something which I'd like to call f squared, but you can immediately tell me, how could it be f squared, because it is not positive definite. And I have an answer to it, but I'll probably skip it now, and we'll explain it if there will be more time left. However, with D-term potential, it just always non-negative. And therefore, to have anything important happening in the D sector is what we need for today. And just as a reminder, what this function F is, this is a function which you see in F mu squared, and the imaginary part of this holomorphic function you see in FF dual. So what else is important to know? There is a chiral superfield auxiliary field F, which I call here P1 plus IP2 by the reason will be explained later. And there is a vector superfield auxiliary field, which is D, and I call it P3. So about 2 years ago, we have written a paper with Kaufman and Linde and Van Pruyen on supergravity and cosmology. And one of the important issues was that if you open the book and look at the version which everybody knows, written by Kremer et al., and you look not only on bosonic term but also on fermionic terms, you will suddenly see lots of terms 1 over W there, where W is a superpotential, which immediately would tell you that if you are familiar with D-term inflation, where the important part of the story is that W vanishes, you would feel very unhappy about starting with the theory which behaves like that. So we have reformulated the whole supergravity story in the form in which this kind of term never appear. And it was done with the purpose to understand more on cosmology. And so the part of it is coming out here. So now I will proceed with cosmological model, which is called hybrid inflation. And it was introduced by Linde in 91, long before it was understood that supersymmetry seemed to favor hybrid type model. Those models have the following feature. They start with slow roll near de Sitter stage, then they change the regime near the bifurcation point. And finally, there is an end of inflation. There is a waterfall stage towards the ground state, and tachyon condensation and reheating. And therefore, you need at least two fields. So for now, everything which we can see in observations doesn't see the difference as to whether it is one field model or two field models. And therefore, those models are neither ruled out nor preferred. And I'll show you the picture, which was of this hybrid type potential, which was prepared a while ago when I started learning all these kind of things. So you have this De Sitter valley, and there is very slow roll along this direction. Then you reach a point of tachyon, and instead of system going from De Sitter minimum into De Sitter maximum, it goes here as a waterfall. So I'll come back to this picture later. And it is realized in one of the brain construction as follows. So first you have a D3 brain, and there is a D7 brain, and there are 3-3 strings and 7-3 strings, and when D3, and there are fluxes on this brain. When D3 is far, you can calculate the spectrum of the hypers, and this spectrum exactly reproduces one of the hybrid inflation model, and then there is a stage of tachyon condensation, and D3, D7 system forms a bound state, and this is an absolute ground state, and the supersymmetry is unbroken. So this is one version of hybrid inflation about which I'll talk more later. And now I want to tell you about F-term hybrid inflation. The story goes back into 80s when it was known that each time you work with F-term inflation, you have a problem. The problem is that generically, the mass of the inflaton is of the order of Hubble, and therefore it completely kills inflation, unless you do the fine tuning. We have two people from the group which has realized that you can do better than that. And this is precisely what is today called F-term hybrid inflation. This group of people made this story. So they have found that if you have a system, so S is an inflaton, and phi plus and phi minus are hypermultiplet fields. And they have found a superpotential such that, see, the Keller potential, even if it is canonical, so you cannot avoid having S squared in the Keller, and it sits in the exponent. So whatever you have here, the Keller potential will always spoil the situation and give this M squared equals H corrections. Unless, of course, you do what they did here. See, in this situation, for this Keller and for this superpotential, there is a cancellation. So there is S squared term from the exponent. There are two S squared term from the property of the superpotential, and minus three from exactly this W squared. And altogether, they completely cancel, and you are left with S4. So,
this seems to be the bad expansion because S is supposed to be larger than 2
units. No.
No.
No, in this regime,
it is not. This is hybrid inflation. Therefore, yeah, this is hybrid. Therefore, what you see here, what was known from 94, you can easily find such Keller and such superpotential that your mass, this is the mass of the S field, is practically zero. And you can call it fine-tuning or whatever, but here is the situation. So generically you have it, but in F-term hybrid inflation, everything works well. Now, D-term inflation, which was invented 2 years earlier, 2 years later, sorry, has the following property. And Pierre Benetri is here, and I spoke to Dvali just an hour ago, checking a couple of things with him on more recent understanding. So here's the situation. You have this F term, and the main property of D term inflation is that during inflation, both the superpotential and the derivative are vanishing. And therefore, they're kind of irrelevant. Now, D squared term is contracted with this function F, and this function can easily be completely inflaton independent. It may be one, or it may depend on dilaton, on volume modulo, but not on inflaton. Therefore, in D-term inflation, generically, the problem M squared of the order H squared does not appear. There is no need for fine-tuning. However, there is a need to understand this issue of Faiyele-Lopez terms. So this auxiliary field in the vector multiplet is given in the case of their model by the combination of positively charged fields, negatively charged fields, and finally there is this Feili-Lopez term. And because it is there, you choose the superpotential and you choose the Keller potential and everything works well. And in terms of four-dimensional effective theory, this is one of the nicest version of Tom.
There's a problem with Feili-Lopez.
Yes, yes, in string theory. I'm going to talk about it. Yes, absolutely. So let me, however, mention something which Andre and I have written recently, which we called P-term hybrid inflation. So there is a model which has, at the level of gauge theory, before you introduce gravity, has a nice feature that it unifies F-term and D-term under one condition that the Yukawa coupling and the gauge coupling are related like that. And there is a symmetry between them. However, if you introduce the coupling to gravity, those models have an additional parameter, F. In D term, this parameter vanishes. In F term, it reaches the maximal value. And in terms of cosmological applications, particularly because I will switch to brain constructions, which will reproduce this kind of model, and I'll tell you what this parameter is in terms of fluxes on the brain. The interesting thing is that those models have a controllable running of the spectral index. This dn over dk, which we heard in the talk of Lem Huey, this parameter is a free parameter in this brain construction. And they also have an interesting feature, which is suppression of cosmic strings. So the typical situation, it is very difficult to justify the fact that the spectral index is 1. But in this case, because of suppression of cosmic strings, it actually takes place. And therefore, those models are interesting. Now, let me show you the potential of these P-term models, which unify D-term and F-term models. The model goes back into hundreds of years ago when Salam, Strasdi, and Fayette have written this model. And n equals 2 theory has three auxiliary fields. There is a triplet. One of them corresponds to the D term, and two of them correspond to the F term. And therefore, there is this triplet of Feili-Lopez terms. The potential in these P term models have the following property. There is an interaction between hypers and neutral field, and this is coming from the analog of F term, and this is coming from the analog of D term. And if you take this potential and rewrite it in the language of n equals 1, you'll find the following situation. This is the term which would come from Keller and from superpotential, and this is the term which is coming from the D term. And so now you see, if I have Xi 1 and Xi 2, and I don't have Xi 3, this is the potential of F term theory. And vice versa, if I have only Xi 3 and I don't have Xi 1 and Xi 2, this is a D term situation. And of course, I could have any intermediate situation. So, because I have this potential leads to the splitting in the mass of the hypermultiplet. Because of this splitting, there is a logarithmic dependence on the inflaton, which actually drives inflation. Moreover, the S squared term cancels, as I showed you before, but there is an S to the 4 term, as well as many other terms which are coming in the exponent, so that the definition of this new parameter F is the contribution of the F term towards the total Feili-Lopez term. And obviously, it varies from 0 to 1. So for D-term inflation, this is vanishing. And then we have minimal running of NS. Where the running of spectral index is coming from? In the observation of MAP, there is no running. But when they combined it with Lyman-Forrest, they seem to say there is running. On the other hand, the more recent studies, we just had a talk, seem to imply that it may well be no running, but some other group of people are still working, and they seem to see some running. So it is quite interesting. The model, as you see it, it is very, it will come from the brain construction. It will naturally have this parameter, and the observational situation is, as of today, is not resolved. So what could happen? It was studied before by Linda and Riota, and the case F equals 1 is actually the model which MAP has shown in their paper, and this would give a maximal running. But if it will turn out that there is much less running, this model of P-term inflation, it may easily describe any version of it. If they will tell us no running, we'll tell then it is just D model. If there is maximal running, it is F-term model. If it is intermediate, it will be this particular P-term model. Now, what are the choices of these three Fiorilopoulos terms? They correspond to a specific choice of fluxes on brains. And I'll also show you the picture, which was in the beginning in Linda Riota paper. So this is the spectral index for the F term, the blue one. This was in their paper from 97, long before MAP measurements. And it was showing that the spectral index goes from negative n minus 1 to positive n minus 1. Now, for D term, the analogous picture, D term never goes beyond, it always stays under 1. But P term could be anywhere between here and here. So whatever the measurements will give us eventually, the model should be able to accommodate it, we expect. Yeah?
You said there was some fine-tuning involved with left-term inflation.
Yeah.
What about P-term inflation? Is it taken care of because of your...
Very good question. When I was talking about P-term inflation, n equals 2 supersymmetry, I was looking only at the gauge potential. At the moment when I tried to go to... coupling to gravity, I immediately lose the symmetry between F and D. And so if the Fiorilopoulos term was associated with F term, I have the Keller potential and I have to worry. And if it is on D term side, I have no problem. On the other hand, it may be if eventually they will find something like that, then we may be interested in some mix of D and F. So this model at the level of gauge theory, which is the brain construction, just give you gauge theory potential, no coupling to gravity. It may well be suitable for the analysis of the measurement simply because there is a free parameter now. Okay, so now I'm ready to discuss the paper which we have written with Shamit, Linda, Maldacena, McAllister, and Trivedi. So, we started with the idea that now we can improve what is called brain inflation models. They started in 98 with Dwali Tai. There were many, many, many papers. One nice review you can find in Quevedo's lectures. And the main drawback of all brain inflation models, as we know them now, is that they assume that there are couple of brains at the distance from each other, brains or brains and antibrains, and they are in finite volume. But the issue of volume stabilization was not addressed. So nobody told us why this volume is what it is and how to achieve this. So for now, therefore, I'll call it naive brain inflation models. The inflaton in all of these models is the scalar which corresponds to the distance between brains. So for example, the distance between brains, for a second I'll use this small letter, and the inner size of internal space, L. So those two brains are in some space, and people study various possibilities. So what we, there are two main points in our paper of many authors. The first point is that even if we take naive brain inflation models, and in particular brain anti-brain inflation models, there was a problem known before that it was extremely difficult to make this slow roll parameter small. And the condition was, it was necessary to make the distance between brain and antibrain larger than the size of the space, which was absolutely made no sense. And so those models were kind of hanging in the air. When we studied this using more powerful tools of string theory, in particular word geometry of Klebanov-Strassler type, the calculations were showing that this slow roll parameter is different from the slow roll parameters which was in the previous model by this nice, really small exponential factor. What was nice about it that you don't need to have very small numbers. Those were reasonable numbers for K and M in Giddings-Kaczy-Palczynski setting, which were known as background fluxes. And so it was easier to make the slow roll parameters small. So this part of the problem was resolved. However, we have found much more serious problem in all brain inflation models. And now I hope that Giddings and Palczynski will tell us something. At least I'll explain the problem. So the general argument that all naive brain inflation models may not work with stabilization of module was suggested and discussed in our paper, which you can qualify as string version of m squared equals h squared problem, which was well known in supergravity, was known how to resolve. And so the setting is, you start in with Giddings, Kaczy-Palczynski, and any source of inflationary energy is some constant divided by r in the power alpha, and alpha is positive. And what is r? R is volume. So what do we do in string theory? We say this is a 10-dimensional metric, which has this r squared as a size of internal space. Therefore, it is a size of a linear scale of our volume. And we have to do some rescaling here to be in the Einstein frame in four dimensions. And then the assumption which was made is that the actual volume is not the superfield which we had before in KKLT model, but it has to be shifted by the linear quadratic combination of inflaton field. And then it was, we gave argument why it is this combination which is actually volume modulus in presence of inflaton. And it was okay as long as we were working with D3 brains. So what we did, we noticed that if we actually want to work with this kind of a construction and have stabilization, we have to introduce some dependence on rho here to break no scale. And then if rho is stabilized as in our previous model, then this would immediately lead to a disaster generically, because then we will always have the mass of the inflaton of the same order as the V0, which is m squared equals h squared problem. And so we have realized that we need some analog of fine tuning, because it is the situation reminding F-term supergravity. And so we have realized that if we introduce in the superpotential, depending not only on the on rho, but also on the inflaton, this may save the situation. And we even made some specific calculation. So the proposal was, here is the problem, let's try to resolve it. And a specific example which we considered, we have this form of the Keller potential, which now includes the inflaton field. And in the superpotential, in addition to exponential dependence due to instanton, we have introduced a sub-exponential dependence on the inflaton. Then after the calculation, we found this is a formula for the mass of the inflaton field. And as you see, in addition to this very bad h-squared term, there were some other terms which depend exactly on this sub-exponential dependence. And therefore, this would be the possibility to do fine-tuning. The problem actually is that nobody in string theory has ever calculated any of those superpotentials. And it would be good to do it. But if they are there, they will give this analog of fine-tuning.
Do you ask the
what?
Do you ask
I think Shamit asked Greg Moore.
Because even the flux part, for example, is there
with the mobile right?
Yes.
Well, this is the non-perturbative curve.
It is non-perturbative.
It is known that there's five dependents in that non-perturbative
curve. Right, in principle.
But it's far from known that it would appear this way.
What kind of dependence we really don't know? Yeah.
So there are some higher derivative directions that are important, actually, as this brain moves around toward the bottom of the throat. Moduli space approximation gets bad at certain regimes, so this is
right. Right. So this situation is not resolved. We see there is a problem in general, and we need more information from string theory to resolve it. But all of this seems to be consistent when we talk about D3 brains only. And so what happened here in Santa Barbara when we all came together, oh, before I do this, I'll show this other transparency. Can we avoid?
Those would be power lock brains in Rome.
We need that some dependence on phi.
To the
right, so those would be probably, well, those are corrections in alpha, powers of alpha phi.
No, they're corrections in phi dot over phi squared. And as phi goes to zero, they become important whatever you do. So they change the dynamics, and that might help.
Now, then the question was, can we avoid fine-tuning altogether, as you have seen in supergravity? If I am an F term, I need fine-tuning. If I am on D term side, there is no need for fine-tuning. And then the question was, can we use this brain D term inflation and the corresponding naive brain construction have been shown to exist? But of course, this is what Tom started immediately, that if you go to the full string theory, the status of Philopoulos terms or rather field-dependent D-terms is not well known. There was much more work on superpotential than on this. And so when I came here, we had long discussion. Just one second. So the recent discussion, which is involved Borges, Shamit, Quevedo, and Maldacena, and there is really a problem. If we want to embed naive brain inflation models into full string theory with volume stabilization, we have a specific issue which we have to resolve before we even say, I would like to solve this problem. So what is the issue which doesn't concern D3 brain, but any other brain? So for example, if I would like to use D7, D3, there is no simple setting in which I can do it. So let me show where the problem is. Let's take again this Giddings-Kaczu-Palczynski with fixed dilaton as a background for D7. And let's do the calculation which gives me the value of the gauge coupling for F mu squared, and I'll find it is R. However, we just agreed that the volume is not this chiral superfield, but it is shifted by the inflaton. And this is not a real part of the holomorphic superfield. Therefore, this contradicts supersymmetry, because remember in the very beginning I told you, if I have an effective four-dimensional theory, for example, coming from brains, in front of F mu squared, I have to have real part of the holomorphic function. And I will always have dependence on R, which is not such function, if I include the dependence on the inflaton. I see you understand. So Juan and I and Shamit for a couple of weeks were, and Fernando and Cliff were debating this. And why it is so important? Because it was this dependence on the inflaton, which was sitting here, and therefore spoiling all kind of good things about inflation. If it would be just 1 over rho, this would not upset inflation. But if it is dependence on R, which includes dependence on the inflaton, we immediately get this m squared equals h squared problem. So our understanding now, the way we formulate it, we are confused, because it is inconsistent to take this ansatz and assume that we have, for example, D7 and D3 at the distance between them is the inflaton. And then if we try to do this, we are in contradiction. So we need a better understanding of what is volume modulus. In presence of DP brains with P not equal 3, then only we may try to promote brain inflation models into full string theory. So the question which is not clear, the issue which is not clear now, after we have written the paper, with D3 everything is clear, but you can immediately check, we checked it back and forth. There is no way you can keep holomorphic property of gauge coupling. And therefore, everything else something has to be changed for this embedding. So therefore, what is the correct dependence on inflaton, which is distance between brains, when we use 10-dimensional metric? When Witten did this ansatz in dimensional reduction 100 years ago, there was no brains. And the field, which is, you know, brain between, distance between brains, was not part of this construction. And he had only usual F mu squared, and there was only the dependence on the dilaton. Now we have a dependence in G squared on the volume, and if it also depends on the distance, then we have problem with supersymmetry because of holomorphic property of gauge coupling. And so to resolve and to embed it, it requires something which we don't know exactly. So the question is, what is the correct ansatz for the metric then, if we have two brains at the distance, which are not just D3 anti D3? And so how to avoid contradiction with supersymmetry? And therefore, I conclude that before, and I think this is what Shamit and Juan agreed with me, that we have to resolve this, and then we may study how to promote naive brain inflation models into full string theory with volume stabilization.
Can you remind me of why you had to add this pi dark pi?
Yes, this is a good question. In fact, we debated it a very long time. What is actually the volume? So on Stanford's side, we thought it was rho. Juan thought it was rho plus rho bar minus phi phi bar. And in Keller, yeah, because you want to reproduce the F-term problem, roughly speaking. But on this side, there should be no problem. And then the gauge coupling may depend on rho. So it is not an issue of having constant Fourier locus. It is an issue of what field dependence is consistent with supersymmetry. So you have to have this G squared in front of D squared, which is the real part of a holomorphic function, which is not when you have it rho plus rho bar minus the inflaton.
Yeah,
this spoils the holomorphic property.
I mean, are you sure that what F is the Kähler is the same?
We're not. But when we simply take the ansatz, the setting of which Giddings, Palczynski, and Kachru told us, here is the metric which tells you what is the volume. And you take a brain and calculate it in this background, you get universally those R terms. So the question is, what is this R? What is the volume when you have brains at distance? This is not clear. And so for now, I will therefore proceed with few things about naive brain inflation models, because eventually we hope to be able to embed them into full string theory with volume stabilization. But as of now, if we have not just D3 but other brains, we have to resolve this ansatz. And in general, when people were discussing, so how actually we got these de Sitter solutions in the first place, is there any 10-dimensional local action whose dimensional reduction will give us this de Sitter? And it doesn't seem to be any 10-dimensional local action when we start using the language of superpotential and Keller potential, because the non-perturbative correction, I think Tom always had this philosophy that this is the right thing to do. And you should not even expect to have local 10-dimensional action, which will include non-perturbative corrections in terms of superpotential and killer potential. But then the question is how exactly you associate a particular choice in your four-dimensional effective action of what is your killer, what is your super, what is your D term, with what is string theory. Okay, so I proceed with the first part, and I'll tell you about, so now I'm back to deep brain inflation. At least there is something we can tell. Without having this ambitious program that it comes from fully understood string theory with volume stabilization. So let's just look at basic features of these models and see what is useful, maybe useful to know. So the models include either brain anti-brain with various numbers of p, or brain-brain at angles, or some models which include dp and dp with some different dimension. So what is the basic features which, after all, I'd like to explain today? They're all deep brain inflation, because those objects are deep brains. And we study various forces between them using string theory technique. So when I have brain anti-brain or same type of brain at angles, the main feature of this system is that when they are far away, there is an attractive force because supersymmetry is broken. This is, roughly speaking, brain at 180 degree. And those have small angles. But as soon as the angles is there, you break supersymmetry, and therefore they are attracted to each other. And then you can use stringy technique and calculate the forces, which many people have done in many situations.
Can I have a very naive question? What is the reason why they should be anything like parallel and flat?
They're not parallel when they're at angles.
Well, but I mean, why aren't they arbitrarily wrinkly and self-intersecting? Who put them?
If they're not so wrinkly that inflation can't start, the wrinkles inflate away. So a high enough scale inflation.
So the same argument for chaotic inflation. Mm-hmm. Somewhere they won't be.
Yeah, those which have such property, which I'll describe now, eventually will lead to inflation, they will survive. And some other which are wrinkled will not, and they will stay small. One of the explanations. But
what is the angle that you need for this
expression? Oh, there was a lot. I mean, you may have seen there are many, many papers. So let me tell you what I prepared, what I know for sure, and then if time will allow, I'll proceed. So the main feature, and again, I had this many rounds of discussion concerning Sen conjecture. So when those brains are at some close distance, which I call critical distance, because typically a tachyon appears, at this stage, in this class of models, you say there is a tachyon condensation. Let us use Sen conjecture. And he tells us that the potential for the tachyon is either exponential or some inverse quash or something like that. And this means that minimum is always at infinite distance. And Kaufman and Linde have shown that there are problems with tachyon reheating, and the exit and reheating is difficult in this class of brains. Now, on the other hand, those classes of brains which are on this side, on which I was working, and I knew that this was one of the reasons why I was working on this, was that if you have, for example, D4, D6, or D3, D7, then the tachyon potential is calculable, and I'll try to show it to you. And therefore, it is known that the minimum is at finite distance, and there is no problem with exit and reheating because it is well-known cosmological system, which you bring it to known solutions. And therefore, it turns out, I'll show that this system have this D-term inflation, but now they may also be understood as F-term inflation in case the observation will tell us there is a running spectral index. And this, again, will make a specific choice of fluxes on, or angles on this side. So how it, okay, just again, this is the potential of these models. And how we proceeded to understand Binet-Tweed Valley D-term inflation using brains. So we place D3 in direction 0, 1, 2, 3. 4, 5 is the distance between them. And D7 sits in 0, 1, 2, 3, as well as 6, 7, 8, 9. And there are fluxes in this internal space, and they're most important. So we allow F6-7, and we call it tan theta, because in the dual version, it will be some angle. And F8-9, and this is tan theta prime. And the most important thing is that theta minus theta prime should not vanish. Then we proceed with the calculation of the spectrum of the string stretched between brains, for which we open a string book of Joe, and we know how to do the calculation. The calculation gives the spectrum. And the spectrum of D3, D7, D7, D3 is split. So the first part of the mass is just the distance between brains. But the plus and minus have this plus and minus, and this is a flux contribution. And if you calculate the mass of the fermion, it is just the central mass in these scalars, where D squared is X4 squared plus X5 squared. Let me show you again this picture. This is a standard calculation of open string theory, and strings are stretched between brains. And so at this stage, when we have the hypermultiplet and the splitting of mass, why I claim that there's different from, I don't need Sen conjecture here at all. The reason is the following. The potential of gauge theory of this P-term potential or D-term potential, which I was showing you before, has the following features. If I have n equals 2 supersymmetry, if I have one vector multiplet, one hypermultiplet with mass splitting, the potential is unique. Therefore, the potential of these fields has simultaneously information about the inflaton and tachyon. And it is precisely the potential which Dvalli and Benetri had. So this is the direction of slow roll, the inflaton, and this is where the point where tachyon becomes and the system goes as a waterfall down. And at fine distance in this tachyon direction, there is a minimum. Therefore, when the system does the waterfall, it starts oscillating and reheat the universe. In Sen conjecture, also he sometimes makes this picture of finite minimum, but the actual dependence is e to the minus t. And therefore, the dependence on tachyon causes problems on cosmological side. So the uniqueness of this potential is coming simply because you calculate the spectrum, and you know exactly that n equals 2 with one vector, one hyper with mass splitting is unique, and therefore you have it all here. Now, there are two, this potential, which is gauge theory potential, because brain construction doesn't tell you anything about gravity, but it picks up a very specific gauge theory potential, which depends on dilaton and hypers. So there is unstable non-supersymmetric vacuum, and this is what I call De Sitter Valley. And this is when D3 is far from D7. On this picture, this is the situation here. When it is far, and when there is, as we will see, flux on the brain, the auxiliary field doesn't vanish. And the inflaton is quite large, and the potential is constant in this gauge model. On the other hand, when you look at this, you'll also recognize that there is another minimum, which is stable supersymmetric vacuum. This is so-called Higgs phase. When the auxiliary field becomes zero, the inflaton is zero because D3 already melted into D7, and the potential is zero. So this is known to string theory as D-flatness condition, and Atiyah, Drinfeld, Hitchin, Manin equation in the instanton construction. For this auxiliary field to become zero, the hypers have to have non-vanishing vacuum expectation value, and it will exactly eat this Fayoli-Lopoulos term. And the total D is zero, and this explains the end story of this and the exit that we are sitting here now. Okay, I'll skip technique. I can flash for you some part of the derivation. We were using all kind of fancy methods to deep brain probes. We had Born-Infeld and Chern-Simon, and all the calculations support this picture. And the most important part was to understand, so how could it be simultaneously non-supersymmetric and supersymmetric when fluxes are still there? And so there is something called kappa symmetry on the walled volume. And we use this construction, which I did long time ago with Berkshoff, Orton, and Papadopoulos, that kappa symmetry on the brain has some feature of rotation. And then you can establish that something which people may understand in their own way, that when D3 is melted in D7, this is a supersymmetric ground state. Like the total energy of the configuration when they were far away went into the bound state, and therefore the energy is zero. And this is what is happening here. So in Coulomb branch, the supersymmetry was broken. There was slow roll inflation because there was this non-self-dual flux associated with Fayoli-Lopoulos term. So how could it be that there is another state, still the flux doesn't vanish in the Higgs branch, and there is a supersymmetric, this exit stage? And the answer was, after some amount of calculation, using this technique of kappa symmetry, that you find an equation which these fields on the brain have to satisfy. And these equations are such that, for those of you who have learned about deformation, there is something which in non-commutative theory is associated with deformation of the field strengths. So the description of D3, D7 bound state and the fact that it is supersymmetric requires this specific nonlinear equation which describes the bound state of a system. And so this Atiyah-Drinfeld-Hitchin-Manin equation follows, and D flatness condition is satisfied when D3 is totally on D7, and D7 still has those fluxes, they do not disappear. So we have all features which we wanted, that the exit stage after tachyon condensation has this Higgs branch, which is completely supersymmetric. So it is tempting to speculate, and I'd like to explain this a little bit, that so in the context of instantons on non-commutative R4, and our R4 is this 6, 7, 8, 9, the internal volume of D7 versus D3. This is, so Witten and Seiberg have studied D0, D4 system, and this is the Euclidean system. So what is known from Nekrasov-Schwarz, that those Fayoli-Lopoulos terms are necessary to make the instantons non-singular. This is their property. On the other hand, in the context of Dirac-Born-Infeld nonlinear instantons, which are written by Seiberg-Witten, as well as Moore and Strominger, they studied those nonlinear instantons with kappa symmetry. Those Fayoli-Lopoulos terms are necessary to have finite non-vanishing instanton number when we describe the bound state. So the speculation which I would like to propose is that the reason why those fluxes are on D7 at the time when D3 is far is, and therefore it is attracted, is so that by the end of the process, when D3 forms a bound state, It is a non-singular instanton. Otherwise, it would be singular. And so there is kind of explanation of the reason for this type of Eliopoulos terms in this construction, because they resolve this D-flatness condition in the exit stage. And the exit stage is rather important. So I switch to more practical matters, which is the current work we're doing with some with students at Stanford. So at the time we were working with Kirchhoff, we just took one particular direction, one angle, or just one direction in the flux space. It was F67 minus F89. And this would correspond to just D-term inflation. Now, because of this interesting situation with not yet resolved running spectral index, we decided to organize the brain construction in a way that we have all three angles in D4, D6, or all non-vanishing fluxes, and there are three independent combinations. If we have all of them, we will be in the situation of P-term construction in effective theory. And so we're in the process of making it. It is just a technical situation. When you have more angles or more fluxes, it is more messy. My understanding is that as of now, the observations are not conclusive. And so I'll show you again the picture from Andrei's paper with Ryota. So at that time, they had this blue line, because they looked only at the F term. And it would be one particular direction for fluxes. And you see, it is this trace of Keller potential where everything blows up because of Keller. For the D term, there is always smooth behavior. The spectral index never blows. And for P term, we could be anywhere in between those two. So when Lem and Seljak. Yeah, but basically, I think the measurements will tell us only about the situation, not be much beyond.
Why do we have this flat?
Why this flat?
Yeah, that intermediate flat region, why?
Okay, so precisely. See, very good question. Why there is intermediate flat region in F-term inflation as well as in D-term inflation? In D-term, because there is no dependence on inflaton on D-term at all, and it never changes. In F-term, at small values of inflaton, fine-tuning killed S-squared term, but S4 is present. When I go to larger fields, it is e to the S-squared, and this is what makes it like that. Okay. So the understanding is that we are preparing a model. It's a nice use of stringy calculations. And if eventually they will tell us, I think during the next month, I don't know whether we will finish the calculation before the observation or not. If they will tell us, basically forget about the running of spectral index, we will say this means that in this class of model, we rather have D term. If they will tell us there is some spectral index, it doesn't go away. Then the idea is, and I was really happy to know that even when we will calculate the spectral fluctuation using the potential of our model, it will not be what they observe. We'll have to give our spectra to people who know what to do. They will use CMB fast and transfer it into something they observe. And then we will have fun of saying that we have these choices of fluxes on brains, and here are observations, and they will tell us what is actually a preferred model in this class of models. I think I have finished. Thank you.